Good evening, everyone. So I see someone I don't know, so I'd like to do names.
Okay. Ellie.
Karen.
Jeff.
Sandra.
Paul.
Wendy.
Marie.
And Carolyn. Carolyn. So Angie asked me to talk tonight while she's away, and she told me that you to continue on really with the Heart Sutra, and she told me that she had talked to you about some about the four ennobling truths last week, and the first three anyway. And she asked me if I would talk about the last one, which is a lot. it's the Eightfold Path. So there's eight facets to it, and kind of, well, what can you say in a few minutes about that? So I'll just try to give a brief outline. And she also asked me to bring this, which is a teaching stick she gave me, so I have it.
Okay.
I'm not sure what you do with it, so she didn't offer any instruction, and I foolishly didn't ask her any, so I'll just try to carry on. So I wanted to begin by saying that in the very earliest discourses of the Buddha, way back, well before the Sarvastivadins, which are mentioned a lot in Red Pine's book, the Buddha did talk about emptiness. So he specifically mentioned this, so which is also mentioned in, of course, which is sort of like a key element of the Heart Sutra. He said, he put it in a couple of different ways, and I'm going to quote a bit. He said, "Nothing whatsoever is worth clinging to. Nothing whatsoever." And then in answer to somebody who came to visit him and asked him a question of what should I do so that the king of death doesn't see me? Kind of people were concerned about that, as we all are concerned about the king of death, I guess. I don't know if it's a king, but certainly a big force. And the Buddha replied, he answered this person, and he said, "Look upon the world as empty, and the king of death can't find you." And then he also said, "Destroy the view of yourself. It is empty of abiding form of solidity." So the Heart Sutra brings this in a very, of course, the early discourses, there's an encyclopedia's worth of them, and the Heart Sutra brings this in later in a very concise, condensed form, and goes through many of the key elements, as Angie has been saying, of the Buddha's early teachings. So Red Pine says that that there's a kind of a Sarvastan view that's very analytical. And I would agree with that. I think the Heart Sutra, that even you could say the Four Noble Truths, or you could say conditioned arising, you could say any of those teachings of the Buddha are analytical. They are a way of looking at, analyzing what we are. What is it about being human? So it's a conceptual framework. But I think the Heart Sutra is a conceptual framework too. It just is very condensed, and it kind of pulls the rug out from under the clinging to an earlier conceptual framework, which is what Red Pine articulates so well about the Sarvastivadins got all hung up on, you know, this and this, and this is real and this is true. This is true. Red Pine actually says the four truths. That one translation of the Sanskrit is, which is satya, is reality. This is real. So, and I think concepts are wonderful and necessary. I mean, they are part of who we are as human beings. We really couldn't there's a history, there's evolution. We've been kind of growing up in this evolutionary way to be conceptual, and that enables us to do a lot of things. So they're wonderful. But the thing about them is that they're sticky. We can hang on to them really easily. We like to put things into boxes and put a framework around things and say, this is the way that it is. Because we don't like to look too much at that reality of everything is always changing. Whether we can perceptually, you know, in our bodily way, see that or not, it in fact, everything is always changing. And that's, there's another part of us that kind of shies away from that, so hangs on to these. So the Heart Sutra does that beautifully, of like cutting out the like, yes, it's this, but it's also this. So instead of being it's this, it's kind of both and. Emptiness is form and form is emptiness. So the four, I like to call them enlightening, for ennobling truths or enlightening truths, because they're active. They're not, there's something that they invite us to engage with them. They're asking us to look at things and to actually do things. So it's not like they're noble truths, just put them up there on the shelf and hang on to them and say, you know, we don't have to think about them anymore. So in the light of looking at it, as Red Pine mentions that some Buddhist scholars do, of looking at these four noble truths in the prajna, in light of Prajnaparamita, they're both asking us to do something and to recognize the emptiness of what we do. In Soto Zen, we don't talk a lot about the Four Noble Truths because we have an emphasis on shikantaza, on sitting, and on the precepts and on the paramitas. But these are all also forms. They're all also conceptual frameworks, and they're all they can all be hung on to, just like the Sarvastivadins did with the four with all of these early Buddhist teachings. And they, 300 years or so, more or less, it's not really clear, but quite a bit, 200 to 300 years after the Buddha's death. They're developed, as will happen in human history. They're developed new ideas and new or different or different people solidified around ideas. Like this is this one. This is what we think. And you can think what you want, but this is what we think. And what we think is right is usually the way it comes down with people. what I think is right. So anyway, I'll go over these, and I just like to also frame my going over them with that I think there's a rough parallel to the paramitas with the four ennobling truths. They're often called right, like the first, and they go in order. They have an order, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. However, it's not a linear order. It's more like a mandala, and I even think of it as more like an intertwined mandala, sort of like a DNA double helix mandala, because it's all of our body, heart, mind. It involves all of us. So you can start anywhere here, but I'll just give them in the, quote, traditional early, and actually the way that the Buddha gave them in the very first discourse he gave, when he had his moment of discovery and said, okay, I think I'll ask the people who were also seeking with me, the five people who were his friends and relatives, to I'll see if they want to hear what I've discovered. And so they came and they listened and they did, and he gave a talk called Setting in Motion the Wheel of the Dharma. This is the order in which he gave the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path. So earlier translations say right view, but more people are turning to, and I prefer to use wise, or sometimes other words like clear, wise view. So this wise view is explained a lot of different ways, but in light of the Prajnaparamita, and my view is that it's experiential and intuitive. What is the view that brought us here? We all had to be seeking something, wanting to discover something, and so we had a view like, well, this might be it. You know? But it's an experience. And then wise intention, clear purpose. So that's the resolve to let this view expand, to stay with it, and to stay with it with being aware through our practices, through Shikantaza, through the precepts, through the paramis, or with other schools of Buddhism, other practices. Really, all schools of Buddhism practice these, the Eightfold Path and the Four Noble Truths, for that matter. So then there's wise speech. So that's a kind of a natural alignment that when we see things and we intend to keep on seeing things, we sort of start to think about our speech. And that is talked about in many ways in the precepts of, you know, the positive and the positive precepts and the prohibitory precepts, you know, not lying or else speaking compassionately, speaking wisely. Then there's wise action. And for me, that's the recognition of interrelation, of non-duality, of really more deeply integrating the precepts for ourselves. And we know this right action, that and even fits in with the wise view. We know when we do an act, it's part of our birthright, our human Buddha nature, to know that when we do something, whether it's right or wrong, but we can develop this and cultivate it. I now think of a time when I was a kid, really, and I love to grow things. I love to grow flowers in a garden, but I lived in the desert, and so it wasn't very easy. And my mother encouraged me, but she wasn't really a gardener and wasn't so interested in it herself. So I was kind of on my own, and wasn't too successful. And then we moved closer to town in kind of a little suburban area when I was going to go to school. So I was like in kindergarten, and on my way to school, I walked to school, and on my way, there were people who did have gardens. And I started picking the flowers and taking them to my teacher. In those days, we had one first grade teacher. And I knew, I mean, even thinking about that, I can feel a little memory, body sensation of knowing that that was really, you know, I was clearly, I mean, and the teacher asked me, oh, did you grow these? And I just went right ahead and said yes. No. But I knew that. And I think we all know that. We all have those experiences. Then there's wise livelihood. So doing our best to be in the world and do work that's beneficial for ourselves and for others. Doing as best we can. That's not always easy, wise livelihood. Wise effort. That's perseverance, you know, sticking with the, it's not always the difficulties that arise in the Buddha way, following the Buddha way. We don't always want to see what is in front of us. We don't always have people that are easy to deal with, or situations in life that are easy to deal with. So, but sticking with it, persevering, not efforting in the sense of too much, you know, not gritting your teeth and hurting yourself physically by sitting too much or too long, but wise effort. Not too much, not too little, just the middle way. And then there's clear attention, it's the seventh factor, or mindfulness. And that's, so this gets a little, tricky with different schools and different developments in Buddhism as to what name you apply to what, but I'll just leave that in the early text as which is what it is called, sati, awareness, mindfulness. And then there's the last is clear concentration or samadhi, which is the mind focused and stable. And so all of these factors together lead to insight and or wisdom. So with the paramis, generosity or dana, kind of our vision and our view relates to those path factors. I mean, it could relate to others too. It's just this is my kind of what came up for me thinking about this. But in your life, there might be other things that generosity could relate to in this path or in other Buddhist teachings. Morality, sila, of course, speech and action and livelihood kind of fit right into that one. But it's also about your intention and purpose, your wise intention, your clear purpose. So it's also part of effort, resolving again and again to be with what is going on. And then there is patience, also intention, shanti in Sanskrit. So again and again coming to being with whatever is actually real in the moment. I know you all studied Norm Fisher's book on Lojong, and he says in there his favorite paramita is patience, and I certainly can relate to that one. There's energy, effort, virya, that's pretty much the same as the path factor, the Eightfold Path factor. Then there's meditation, danya, janya, which actually, and since this is kind of where there's a coming together for me in my understanding of mindfulness and concentration, because mindfulness is not just one thing, and concentration is not just one thing. Mindfulness, in fact, the way that it works is moment-to-moment concentration. There's always a returning to, a recalling of, and an awareness of But it's returning to, can be one object, like we sit with our breath in Zen when we do Zazen, but as we all know, when the mind also, many other things arise, mind sensations, body sensations, memories, thoughts, you know, things come up, and we can have very open and wide awareness in our Zazen too. So it's not like a focus concentration practice, like you have just one thing that you're returning to. And then there's wisdom, prajna, paramita. Prajna, paramita. It's what we're incorporating, literally putting into our bodies when we say, when we chant the prajna, paramita. And that's experiential. That is the, that's a unification, if you will, of mind, body, heart experience. It's wisdom. So these are all skillful means, upaya. And we can look at them in that way, that they're there for us to pick up and use as we become familiar with them, and as we become, as they become incorporated in us, as we live them in our lives. The Buddha had lots of similes and stories in his early teachings about the not clinging part, about the part that. That the prajna paramita specifically addresses, not this, not that, both and. Form is emptiness, emptiness is form. By implication, the structure, the kind of the grammatical and what is the word I want? Maybe literary. I don't know if that's the right word, but structure of the whole prajna paramita. Every implies that to every pair of opposites, they come together. You can't fix on one, and you can't fix on another. You can't fix on emptiness, and you can't fix on form, and you can't fix on the Eightfold Path or wise speech. But it's there. It is there. It's without a doubt there. Like we are here. We have form. We're not just empty concepts. Minds. Floating around. So they're both, three things together without holding on to one or the other. And the Buddha talked about that in this simile, the famous parable of the raft, when he said, you know, these are all skillful means and use them. And when you discover for yourself and know in your heart, body, mind, that this is so, you build the raft with these tools, but you use the raft. The tools are the paramis, the precepts, sitting itself, meditation. The whole Buddhist path is our guidelines to help us know how to steer that raft toward what? Toward living our lives in the best way we can. And then when we feel like we have understood, then we don't hang on to those things. We don't have to be always thinking, am I doing wise speech? Am I being empty? Am I in form? Am I in emptiness? We've put them inside, and so they're there for us. So, I'll leave you with one last reflection of my own, which actually is kind of a metaphor, an image that came to me of reflection. So these are prajna paramita and all the early Buddhist teachings, which the Prajnaparamita includes. It not only negates them, it includes them. So they are, and it says, don't hang on to them. It's a reflection for us, but it's not like a mirror reflection. It's a window reflection. So when we see in a window, when the circumstances are right, we can see ourselves, and we can see beyond ourselves, we can see through the window, and we can even see behind ourselves if the circumstances are right. We can see what's going on behind us. And then I had one. See, I'm very keen on a wonderful Buddhist teacher, Deshi Maru, whom Angie introduced me to and studied. And I believe she's given you that reference to Deshi Maru's book, Musha Toku Mind. So that's actually means in Japanese, Musha Toku, the mind of not clinging. And the mind of the empty mind that doesn't cling, something like that. And these are a handout, but I'll just say one quote from him, and you can read this if you like, and get into him further if you like. The great wisdom of Prajnaparamita can equally arise, as was the case for Shakyamuni Buddha, from the observation and comprehension of the Four Noble Truths, which form the fortunate path of realization. So he was a Soto Zen master. I think he died in the early 60s. He was French and studied in Japan a long time, and then came back and taught in the West in France. And I did want to say one other thing, and that is, because it's National Poetry Month, I'd like to leave you with, from my point of view, and then I would love to hear what you want to say, with Ryokan, with the words of Ryokan, another Zen master from a long time ago. Buddha's path. This is the way to be traveled in this world. This is the way to be traveled, to return to the world. I too come and go along the sacred path that bridges life and death. And I can't quite read this. I don't have my glasses with me. And banishes illusion. This is the path. So thank you. And maybe someone has something that they would like to say.
Talking about internalizing the paramitas and the eightfold path reminds me a lot of what I learned how to ride a bicycle.
Yeah, that's a nice analogy.
Once I learned how, I didn't think about it anymore. Just get on and rode.
Once you have the bicycle, once you know how to do it, but you still have to. You still are knowing what you're doing,
sure.
But you're not thinking about it. Yes,
exactly.
I agree.
You're not thinking about, am I going to hit that guy?
Or am I going to fall off?
Am I going to fall off? Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Ellie.
I liked your image so much of the looking through the window. Mm. But can you... So this is what your metaphor of the window is, the Eightfold Path, is the...
Well, it's more for me the Buddha path,
okay,
the whole way.
Yeah.
Right,
okay.
Prajna Paramita too.
Okay.
But in whatever form we choose, I mean, we may not ever think about, because we are practicing in this form, we may not think too much about the Eightfold Path again. We have other guidelines, and so it's those, the paramis, the paramitas, the precepts.
It's a really compelling image, and it's one that I think will help me kind of somehow conceptualize in a way, or just have a... I just like it so much, you know, looking forward through the window, seeing yourself and also seeing a little bit of what's behind. It's just, in terms of trying to develop a more open attitude towards myself and what's going on, you know, to not feel that I'm so separate, to feel that I'm part of whatever it is that's going on. I find that helpful.
It's in a way about the wind, that image, I don't know, it just came to me, that image, but it's also, you see the transparency of yourself in a window. You see that you're not really real in the way that we ordinarily take ourselves as real. You know, we are real. We're form. Okay, we're human and we're imperfect, as we were chanting today, this evening. But you know, that just that part, the parts that we chant, it just kind of undercuts itself. And I'm remembering teachings that Angie gave me a while ago, when we've studied the Heart Sutra many times with Angie, and the, you know, how can that be that, you know, you're just saying there's no enlightenment, there's no, you know, there's no realization, there's no this, and yet you're going to be... And all the Buddhas have perfect enlightenment, and the chant itself that is perfect, transcendent, you know, all of that. How can that be? There's this paradox in this beautiful little small piece of Buddhist writing that just brings us right up to it, of both and. It is and it isn't. We can't be perfect. I mean, that's really exactly what I thought when we were chanting that. There's no way. We are imperfect beings. And we have Buddha nature. So what is Buddha nature? If we have that, if we can recognize what that is, then was Buddha perfect? No? Do we have to hang on to him? That's a question. So we have time for more if people want to say something, or if not, that's fine too. Jeff?
When you were speaking about opposites not being separated, reminded me of the spectrum, the colors.
Mm.
When we're asked, which is blue, it's like, well, we're clearly, obviously, that's blue, but when we're asked where the blue ends and the green begins, then we start inventing more and more colors, and it just, it's like turtles all the way down. So So that's how the Eightfold Path seemed to me, is like, when we want to identify right speech, like, clearly that's right speech, but where does that right speech end and right living begin? Well, then it starts to blend together. We can either just let it blend together and all be a seamless whole, or we can start inventing more and more colors to try to describe something that's kind of just seamless in a spectrum. That's how it seems to me, anyway.
Yeah, that's a great analogy, too. And actually, I just remember looking at a spectrum somewhere in my distant past. It must have been in high school or something. I didn't really look at any spectrums in college, I don't think. But, you know, that's how they actually do shade into each other. That's the one I remember seeing. It shades. It's not like there's blue. In the light spectrum, there's blue, and then there's... It actually... Just as you describe. It is our tendency to want to do that, so I guess that's a great benefit of the Heart Sutra. It reminds us that we'll never grasp the whole, that everything is much bigger than we as humans can ever grasp. Even astrophysicists recognize this. They talk about this. I just want to know a little more how it works. But so I do want to apologize for, or maybe that I shouldn't be using that term. I'm not sure, actually, but. For forgetting the form of an unsurpassed and penetrating and perfect Dharma is rarely met with before I spoke. So maybe
no problem. It varies.
It varies, right? I know that's a great thing about practicing in this particular tradition.
I'm not attached to that form.
The form varies, and
the intentions there.
Yeah. Besides, we got the Dharma.
I think it was a few weeks ago. It was really crowded in here. And just that difference in how many people showed up, I completely forgot what to do after Kin Hin. Everyone was trying to circle around to their seat, and I tried to just walk straight back. No reason that I could
serve. Exactly. Yeah. We're imperfect, and even no matter how long you study in the rest of your life, I mean, Angie has stories about Koban and, it's kind of late to get into all that, but I'm sure you'll hear them or have heard some. Just
there is a koan about the perfectly enlightened person who falls into a well.
Oh, I didn't know that one. That's a good one. Just walking along
and boom.
Just didn't notice that form.
No different from anybody else.
Didn't notice that physical form right in front of him. That's a good one. So maybe we sit for 1 minute.